When the book is written on Detroit's bankruptcy, this past week will be a big chapter. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, why we are at a major tipping point in the nation's largest municipal bankruptcy. But first, you can be fired or denied a job in Michigan, or denied housing if you're gay. Michigan's civil rights law, the Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act, does not include LGBT protections, the same way it does for race, ethnicity, and gender. But yesterday, Democrats at the state capitol proposed legislation to add sexual orientation and gender identity to Elliott Larson. Jonathan Osting of MLive joins us now. Jonathan, word was that a Republican, State Representative Frank Foster, was prepared to introduce this legislation. That didn't happen. What did?
Well, exactly. Frank Foster was actually circulating a bill on the House floor for co-sponsorship late last month, but he decided to hold off on introducing the bill because there's still some legitimate concerns in the Republican caucus about the relationship between LGBT protections and religious liberty. There are concerns from some members that an employer might be denied their right for total religious expression if they are subject to this new proposal. So Democrats had been waiting around for Republicans to introduce the bill, hoping that that would spur some bipartisan action. But when they found out there was going to be a delay, likely until at least lame duck, they went ahead and introduced bills, which they've proposed in previous sessions. So Democrats were, you know, already on record supporting this sort of push, and they were just hoping that they'd have some companions.
Right. And there's definitely this level of politics going on. Frank Foster, the Republican millennial from Petoskey, he was defeated in his primary by a fellow Republican. So how much of that is playing into this introduction?
Well, everyone says that that doesn't actually matter, but, you know, the general election is fast approaching, so I think it's certainly on everybody's minds. Frank Foster was criticized in his home district by his Republican challenger on a number of issues, including his support for updating Elliott Larson. So it played a role in that race. It's not clear how large of a role, but certainly some sort of role, and I don't think Republicans are necessarily eager to take up the debate with the general election fast approaching. They'll say certainly that they're willing to have this debate this year. It's likely going to happen in lame duck, if at all.
We had Governor Snyder in May saying he wanted the legislature to take up the issue to debate it, though he will not say whether he supports it or not. Then in July, Senate Republican leader Randy Richardville said that he would support it. So how much of this is House Speaker Jace Bulger putting his foot down and saying not so fast?
Well, Bulger is certainly sort of leading the debate over the religious liberty argument. He's trying to find a way, as he puts it, to balance protections for LGBT workers and religious expression of employers. He says he hasn't gotten there yet. Frank Foster wasn't going to introduce a bill if he's not sure where his leadership actually stood on the issue just yet. So that debate's going to continue. Certainly, Bulger is the one that's trying to, as he puts it, find a solution. Critics might say that he's held up the debate to this point.
Right. And as you said, Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville says votes will not happen, at least in his chamber, until the legislature's lame duck session, meaning that is not until after the November elections. What do you see happening come lame duck?
Richardville reiterated today that it will certainly hold a hearing at least. So there definitely will be a public debate on this, I do believe. Whether or not that public debate leads to action really remains to be seen. Rebecca Warren, who introduced the bill on the Senate side, her bill today was referred to Richardville's own Government Operations Committee. So he certainly has, the ball's in his court, as it were.
And what are you hearing at the Capitol? What are the murmurs about this, that this is time, that this is just politics? What's sort of the word on the ground?
Well, there's certainly, you know, some belief that it is time to have this debate, although the way things went down this week has sort of raised some questions about how feasible it's going to be to get this through the legislature. The fact that a Republican had a bill, was already seeking co-sponsors for it, and for whatever reason, through discussions that happened behind the scenes, decided not to introduce it this month, isn't a great sign for the progress on the issue. So, you know, the supporters still say they expect something to happen, but we'll see.
Jonathan Osting of M Live, thanks so much.
Yes, absolutely.
And State Senator Rebecca Warren, who introduced the legislation to add gender identity and sexual protection to Elliot Larson, issued this statement today. She said, updating the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act is about protecting our citizens and their families from being fired from a job or being denied housing because of whom they are or who they love. Again, that statement from State Senator Rebecca Warren. Ceremonies and exhibits are taking place across Michigan today to mark the anniversary of the September 11th attacks. Governor Snyder is the guest speaker at the Michigan Fallen Heroes Memorial in Pontiac. The ceremony will include the unveiling of 11 names of police and fire personnel to the memorial. And many, many other events are scheduled throughout the state, including in Detroit, Ann Arbor, Grand Rapids, Kalamazoo, and Flint. And you can find the story of how it came to be that the state of Michigan actually owns the blueprints, the architectural prints to the World Trade Center buildings. It's a really, really interesting story. That's online at MichiganRadio.org. We've also linked to it on the Facebook page. So let's talk a little football now with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. Hey, John.
Hello, Zoe.
So, John, I want to talk job security. That's after U of M football lost pretty badly, I'd say, to Notre Dame last Saturday. And there is some talk about Michigan coach Brady Hoke and his job security. Is that fair?
Whether it's fair or not, of course, this is the business of college football. So there it is.
What folks are saying is he's got to do better on road games, right? And for the first time since 1966, Michigan will be on the road at MSU, at Ohio State. How big of games are those?
Very big, especially when Ohio State seems to be down. They had their star quarterback, Braxton Miller, who's a Heisman Trophy hopeful. He went down in the offseason, and now the backup is clearly a far backup, it looks like. They've already lost to Virginia Tech at home. So Ohio State is not what it was. Michigan State is still good, but they got beaten themselves, of course, by Oregon at Oregon. And the whole Big Ten right now is down. So even though Michigan's not a great team right now, certainly, the way the schedule lays out, people would expect them to win some games.
So what is going on? I mean, what is this dynamic here then between home games and away games for the Wolverines? Is it just the team? Is it Hoke?
It's hard to figure in some ways. This team under Hoke is 0-12 on the road against ranked teams. So in other words, whenever they play anybody good, they lose on the road every single time, unfortunately, for Michigan fans. Bo always told me, Bo Schembechler, that is, the old coach, and I can't quite figure this one out, but he swore by it, that you never knew how tough your team was until you went on the road, because they're cheering against you, your friends aren't there, it's 60 people versus the world, and your goal is to shut up 100,000 people. So far under Hoke, that seems not to be what they're doing. And the other catch right now with Hoke, Hoke is a beloved figure. From the day he took the podium as the head coach and said, when someone asked him, are you going to have to rebuild? He said, this is Michigan, for God's sakes. So that went on T-shirts very quickly. They went 11-2, but then they went 8-5 the second year, 2012, and then 7-6 last year. So unlike Rich Rodriguez, who was unpopular at first and was winning more games but never quite won the fans over, Brady Hoke won the fans over immediately, started out very strong, but he's sliding in the wrong direction, and that gets people anxious.
Right. Now, a sports writer for the Detroit News compared Hoke to Rich Rodriguez, as you said, U of M's former coach who was fired. Now, Rich Rod was fired after just 3 seasons. Hoke has a better record than Rich Rod, but as this Detroit News writer said, Hoke was not brought here to be mediocre. He was brought here to win championships, which he has failed to do.
That is true, and Hoke, I suppose to his credit, came out right away and said, look, this is Michigan. Our goal every year is a Big Ten title. So even when they won the Sugar Bowl, a BCS bowl, in his first year and went 11-2, which is very good, obviously. He said, we didn't win the Big Ten title, so therefore it's a failure. Well, sadly, by his terms, therefore all 3 years have been a failure, and this fourth one is setting up to be another one if they don't get their ship going in the right direction.
So then what happens?
What happens, I think, this year, if it's not make or break for Hoke, it sure is close, I think. And to me, it's less the number of total wins at the end of the season, not, you know, 8, 9, or 10, but the direction of the program. Are they getting better? Is there reason to think that another year would result in better results, of course? And in that case, of course, what you're trying to avoid is a revolving door of coaches whereby every 3 or 4 years you get a new one. That is not good for recruiting the next great coach, of course. You get a reputation for that. So that's not a good thing. The flip side is mediocrity is not Michigan's milieu, naturally, and in the last 10 games, Brady Hoke is 3-7. That is not the right direction.
Okay, let's come back to the present day, short term. U of M playing Miami of Ohio on Saturday. They've pretty much got to win this game, no?
If they don't win the game, really, it's over, because this is Miami of Ohio, keep in mind, not Florida. And this is also a very bad Miami of Ohio team, even by their standards. So this should be a walkthrough. And then they get a little bit tougher against Utah and then into the Big Ten season. But this one should be a walk through the way App State was 2 weeks ago.
Okay. John U. Bacon, sports commentator for Michigan Radio. Hey, John, thanks so much.
Zoe, always a pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Cynthia Canty. More than 100 years ago, Methodist missionaries set up Indian mission churches in northern Michigan. Their goal was to bring Christianity and to do away with traditional American Indian belief. Today, the missions blend the traditions, but they serve small congregations that can't afford to pay their pastors. The United Methodist Missions have survived with lots of financial help from the denomination, but now leaders say they have to scale back. And for one mission pastor, it feels like a broken promise. Interlochen Public Radio's Linda Steffen reports.
You're strong and mighty, you're mighty in battle, you're high, high,
singing at an outdoor Friday night worship service, the traveling musical duo Rain Song led revival-type meetings this summer in Northport.
All right, we're going to all turn to the east now. That way over there, yeah, follow the pastor in the back, he knows.
Long before European missionaries introduced Christianity, praying to the four directions was a tradition among American Indians.
Welcome here. Now turn to the right, to the south, to your right. Open up the gates, you got it.
Worshiping with a crowd of about 20, they sing to Jesus and to the great chief, the warrior and creator. This type of blending of cultures was not encouraged by early Christian missionaries. And Pastor Tom John says even when he was a boy, he was taught in Sunday school he could not be both Indian and Christian. As an adult and a man of God, he sees the culture of his ancestors from a different view.
We had never had the Bible, but we always believed that there was a God. And everything that we did in our traditions that they said was paganism was how we related to God in our understanding. We called him by different names, but what we were doing in our traditions, in our ceremonies, were exactly what the church is doing. Only it was more meaningful for us in our relationship with the Creator.
Praise God from
Pastor Tom John runs two Indian mission churches, one in Northport and the other across Grand Traverse Bay, in the Antrim County town of Keewaydin, where common Christian songs are sometimes sung in both English and the native tongue of local tribes. Usually, the crowd, which can be less than 10, sings without instruments. Right next door, there's another active, larger United Methodist Church. Both are painted white. They look like twin buildings. It's an odd sight from the road. Next door, a mostly Caucasian crowd gathers.
This church here next door will come and participate in what we do. We go and participate in what they do. But because of those differences, we just like to remain two separate churches.
The problem is money. The pastor who oversees all United Methodist churches in the Grand Traverse District is Anita Hahn. She says the district chips in tens of thousands of dollars a year for the Kuwaitan Indian Mission, as it has long done also for missions in Northport and Charlevoix.
They have been our mission churches, and we have sought to sustain them as the United Methodist Church. And what's really hard right now is overall, the United Methodist Church is decreasing. And so that means all of our monies are decreasing. And as we try to support our native churches, we don't want to decrease funding. But is it the wisest fiscal choice to continue to support them at the same rate that we've always supported them?
Two churches, two pastors, serving a town of about 2,000 people. That's expensive. And Pastor Anita Hahn says her hope is that at some point, the two churches will become one.
And to become the church that's immersed in the native culture, that's immersed in who Christ is calling us to be, the hands and feet of Christ. And if we break down some of that division, are there healthier ways that we can really reach all of us? Yeah, as I say that, I don't know that that's what's going to happen. But I dream about what's next.
She says in her mind, that doesn't necessarily mean giving up either the Indian Missions building or its separate services, but it would mean sharing pastors and becoming one entity. Pastor Tom John is against pulling back financial support. He says that breaks a promise made to his community by Methodist leaders more than a century ago as the Indian missions were established, but he's also not opposed to a merger with his neighbor. He wanted to retire long ago, but there's no one to replace him. Key to a merger, he says, would be a pastor who understands the native traditions and Christian worship and who would keep this going even if attendance on Sunday is small.
We hold our services more informal. At the church next door, is very formal. I went over there a few times and it was rather different.
Stephen Antwine tends graves behind the Indian mission that date back to at least 1860. He helps care for the building and the grounds, a lot of work for a small congregation. He grew up here in Kuwaitan and has always been in the minority here. But he has heard stories of a time when the tables were flipped, when this place was known as Indian Town. He says the mission is an important connecting point for those who remain.
For me, the Kuwaitan Mission, the United Methodist Conference, well, mainly the Kuwaitan Mission, is part of my family. You know, we pray together, even though it's kind of informal in a way, people still keep coming back. It's like they leave home and they come back to home.
Antwine says he knows churches are folding and merging everywhere, and that over time, many do give up their buildings. Whatever happens, he hopes to see this small mission services and its traditions live on.
You have shown us, Creator, what you require to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly in your sight.
Interlochen Public Radio's Linda Steffen reporting for Stateside. And now, a story of failure from Failure Lab, Grand Rapids.
My failure.
My divorce.
I felt totally bamboozled.
And I thought, this has to end. I can't do this anymore.
Here's Kathy Crosby.
My failure has been part of me my entire life. Although I can't tell you the exact minute it started, I don't remember a day without it, and I can't escape it. I grew up on a farm with gardens and orchards, and my mother worked outside in the gardens, and so my grandmother took care of me. Grandma taught me to cook and to bake and to sew and to quilt and to crochet and tat. There's a word you haven't heard in a while. And I loved every lesson. I would sit with her for hours learning to do the crafts that she taught me. And if I was a good girl and everything was going well, my reward would be a personal picnic lunch Grandma would pack my picnic basket, and I'd take my blanket and a favorite book and go sit in the orchard and have time to read. I loved the Bobbsey twins. It was idyllic, a perfect childhood. But even then, I was feeling the early pangs of failure. And it came in the form of rejection by other children. You see, all that hanging out in the kitchen and sitting around and doing those lovely crafts meant I was putting on extra pounds. When I was in the fourth grade, Mrs. Rundle used to line us all up in the front of the classroom at the beginning of every marking period and weigh us and measure us and record it on a great big chart so we could see how we were growing. Such fun. Well, Mrs. Rundle, one day, as she put me on the scales, exclaimed, "Well, Kathy Sue, you weigh more than I do." Oh, and I melted, and I could hear the children laughing behind me. It was a terrible moment. But I survived, and I went off to junior high. Anybody have a fond memory of junior high? Exactly, yeah. So you know how this goes, right? I'm 13. Nothing's good about 13, and I have Miss Cook for gym. You have to take gym for a semester, and Miss Cook had a whole list of physical things that you had to master, and your grade depended on how many of those things you could do. We had to truck off to the local dry goods store and get our gym uniform. The gym uniform was this little one-piece jumpsuit thing that only went up to a size 20. That's the size I bought, and it just barely fit. Now, I was great as the base on the pyramid. I could somersault, and I even learned how to do a tripod. But as you can imagine, climbing a rope, a handstand, oh, that didn't go well. It was the worst grade I ever got in school. But off to high school, I compensated. My refuge was reading, writing, and arithmetic. I loved my studies. I took all the advanced placement classes. I was part of the National Honor Society. I did the debate club. I joined the yearbook staff. All nice sedentary activities. But all the way through high school, never a date for a dance or the prom. And I never learned to dance, so that was out of the question. I was awkward and cloddish. But after high school, off to business school, Dad sent me, and my first job was as a teletypist, more sitting. A couple years later, I got married, and by our first anniversary, I found out I was expecting our first child. In the next 3 years, I had two children, and I gained 100 pounds. On my 24th birthday, I weighed 280 pounds. I had these two really active kids, and I couldn't keep up with them. Oh, I can get down on the floor with them really good. Getting up was a really big problem. There was no riding bikes with the children. There was no playing tag with the children. I was doing my best. Life was very busy. But I was very slow. In the years ahead, I did go back to work as the kids went off to school. And in the 80s, I decided to go to college. You know what the worst part of college was? There was no online learning in the 80s, believe me. I had to walk across the parking lot to those buildings and walk between the buildings for the classes. I would get so winded, and it would take me so long. It was just the greatest challenge to move. But I stuck in. I made it. And in 1993, I got a bachelor's degree. I was so proud. I also hesitated to go to commencement. I weighed 365 pounds. In 1994, I finally looked around and said, I have to do something. I have to fix my physical self. And so my husband bought a treadmill for me, and I started to walk. 10 minutes was a big deal. I walked 10 minutes, and then 30 minutes, and then an hour. And pretty soon I was walking an hour and a half a day on the treadmill. I started to watch what I ate, and I got my doctor to give me some support. And I'm really proud to say that in the spring of 1995, I had lost 140 pounds. Yes. It was a really great time, and the next 15 years were really busy. My husband and I moved to Maryland. I had a chance to boost my career, and so the years went by until I was ready for a new challenge. And that challenge was here in Grand Rapids. And so in 2006, my husband and I moved to Grand Rapids. I found a challenge, all right. In 2012, I was diagnosed with cancer. Now, those words from your doctor change your life. They change your perspective. You start to think differently about everything. The weeks ahead were all about treatments and hospitalization, medicine. I talked to my specialist at the University of Michigan Hospital and said to him, what do I have to do to help me get better? And he said to me, eat, sleep, and move. And so I bought a Fitbit. I mean, how, you know, itchy is that? And I started walking the halls of the hospital. I walked every day. My husband would be there. I'd have IV poles. I'm walking the hallways, and I'm counting my steps. And I did get well. 9 months after the diagnosis, I was declared in complete remission. That's the word you always want to hear. Thank you. But I was also 55 pounds lighter. And for the first time in my life, I was a normal size. My body mass index fell in the normal range. I walk by a window or a full-length mirror, and I always take a start and say, who is that? I really don't recognize that person. But it's so much easier to move. There are so many things I can just bend over and pick up. I have grandchildren I scoop up and play with. And yet, I don't play and run or ride. I still feel cloddish and awkward. And I know it's my self-perception that gets in the way of me being able to move through life. And so, I've never played any sports or played a round of golf or a game of tennis with friends. I've never gone bike riding with my grandsons. My daughter's a runner, and I've never run with her. But probably the greatest failure is I've never learned to dance.
That was Kathy Crosby telling her story of failure. You can find out more about Failure Lab and hear more stories at failure-lab.com. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. big news out of Detroit this week, a deal over a Southeast Regional Water Authority and a tentative deal between the city and one of its largest creditors. Meantime, lawmakers back at the state capitol after their summer recess, and the two big statewide races for governor and the open U.S. Senate seat continuing to heat up. Let's take a step back and see how all of these events fit together and are impacting one another. Detroit News columnist Daniel Howes joins us as he does most Thursdays. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, how are you?
Good. And also with us is Rick Pluta, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network and my co-host of It's Just Politics. Hey, Rick.
Proud co-host.
So let's begin, Daniel, with an update on just what happened this week in bankruptcy court. Kind of a historic week. Two big news stories, Water Department and a deal between the city and creditor Syncora. Fill us in.
Yeah, huge, huge tentative agreements. This water battle has been going on, as people know, for years here. And I think finally you've got a combination of leadership in Mike Duggan and also federal mediators who brought people together. And as Oakland County Executive Brooks Patterson said, the sword of Damocles was hanging over them because they did not want a federal judge to make these decisions for them. So as a result, we've got it appears to be a pretty historic deal on water that will continue to pump about $50 million a year into the updating the system, and everybody will have a say, and it's pretty cool, I think. And we're going to hear more about it later this week. And at the same time, you had a deal with Syncora, which was one of the holdout creditors that had been beating the city about its head and shoulders, metaphorically, over the grand bargain, over the mediators saying they were biased, and now all of a sudden they are friends, and they're on the same side and left one other financial creditor out in the cold. So it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. There's some mediation going on as we speak that needs to be wrapped up by sometime on Friday, and if it is successful, then the Syncora deal probably will go forward. And then they'll resume the trial on Monday.
Right. Folks saying things like when we look back at this bankruptcy trial, that we'll be looking back at this week as sort of the week that possibly, you know, put an end to the trial or made it look like there was an end in sight. Rick, what is the talk in Lansing right now? How focused are folks on what's happening in Detroit?
Well, not terribly, and for these people, that's kind of good news.
Mm-hmm.
That both the water deal and the Syncora deal, although I would say the Syncora deal in particular, sort of, you know, there was this big collective sigh of relief among the supporters because all of a sudden this is suggesting that their efforts and you know the sweat, anguish, and controversy that they endured is going to pay off with the city exiting bankruptcy and doing what everyone hoped would happen in this process.
Which has been sort of interesting to watch. I mean, right now, Lynn, let's not, you know, the three of us jinx it, but it is sort of going on this path. And part of why we got this far into the bankruptcy is because of, you know, what we're calling the grand bargain. State lawmakers played a part in this by okaying a $350 million settlement. Others, of course, calling it a bailout to the city.
Mm-hmm.
That was an incredibly controversial vote, Rick, and now it's sort of crickets.
Yeah, and I was talking just yesterday with State Representative John Walsh, who kind of rode point on this, and I asked him, so what might have to happen next? And he said, hopefully nothing. That, you know, we've done our job, we've crossed the T's, dotted the I's, and you know, you this is all so new that, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, but his hope and the hope of Rick Snyder and others is that really that you know, the Lansing end of this, that they'll just sit back and watch it all play out in the way that that they had hoped. Now, you know, what we're going to be watching for, of course, is, you know, we're now moving from measuring Kevin Orr's remaining time in office in all probability,
mm-hmm.
in you know, not in months, but weeks and then days. And the question is, what is Kevin Orr going to use with that time? That people here are looking at, for example, the Pontiac emergency manager, Lou Schimmel, the very last emergency manager order he signed created sort of an emergency manager light, a city manager who has a lot of emergency manager powers going forward in the city of Pontiac. No one is really expecting that in Detroit, just because Orr and Mayor Duggan seem to have formed an alliance, a working relationship, that maybe he'll take on some of that role. But it shows that there are still a lot of things that Kevin Orr can do to dramatically affect how this is going to play out going forward.
Sure, and let's talk a little bit about that in a minute or two. But Daniel, I want to bring you in after that $350 million settlement, the votes for it. Detroit sort of got what it needed from Lansing. How are Detroit business leaders and folks in Detroit reacting to that? Are they sort of okay? We got what we needed from Lansing. Let's be done with them.
Well, I don't know if I'd put it that way, but I think what you're seeing here is a remarkable alignment both of political and business leadership across the state behind this Detroit bankruptcy effort and among the population. I mean, it's a little old now, but we did some polling at the Detroit News of statewide polling of this, and it was remarkable the broad support for what the state was proposing to do at the time, and in general, getting Detroit through bankruptcy. I think the leadership has really affected the way people view this whole process. And one of you said it was crickets after this, and I think that's a very good sign, because I think people realize that everybody had to play a role here, and a lot of people are playing roles here. And it's remarkable. I've said to my wife many times, I don't think a lot of people appreciate what these people, broadly speaking, are accomplishing. And I mean bankruptcy teams, legislators, the governor's team, Mayor Duggan as he's gotten involved, suburban leaders who have finally kind of realized they had an opportunity here in the water department, and they got their arms twisted a little bit by federal mediators, no question. But what they're accomplishing is something that I think a lot of us who've been around here a long time thought we'd never see happen.
Well, particularly in a city like Detroit, where it feels like for years and years most of the headlines were about dysfunction and inadequate leadership.
Yeah, and I think what this shows, to me at least, as someone who's written a lot about leadership in business and in politics, is that leadership clearly matters. And tone matters, and I think you have in Mayor Duggan, for example, you have somebody who is less overtly partisan. I'm not saying he's not partisan, but he's less overtly partisan. He's more interested in fixing problems, and I think he knows that the more he fixes and the more he addresses and the more he is pragmatic, that redounds to his political benefit, as well as it improves what's happening in Detroit. He's very pragmatic in that sense. And to piggyback on Rick's point about what Kevin Orr is likely to do in his final days, I would be surprised if he did anything really to punctuate his term. I think his relationship with the mayor is generally pretty positive. The mayor made it clear earlier this week that he thought that they would be doing a transition at the end of the month, and that Kevin will become a bankruptcy advisor. He will lose the title of emergency manager and probably step out of that role. I think there's every expectation on the part of the Snyder administration that the mayor ascends to that role in a de facto sense as mayor, and he continues down that road. I do not think they want to put some kind of proxy in there in an interim, because I think politically I think that's somewhat fraught, and I think it is. I think it would be a mistake.
Well, one of the worst things that could happen would be for there not to be a high level of control restored to the city, because that would essentially be a failure. Now, the bigger failure would be if somehow the city were to slip back into financial turmoil. But really the second worst result, and it would be a close second, would be that there's not a large degree of political control restored to the city's elected leaders, because that is supposed to be the point of this process.
You're exactly right. And I think the other thing that we need to be mindful of is elections have consequences. And we're looking at a statewide election for governor here in a couple of months. Mayor Duggan is not going to be mayor forever. City councils change. So the question, I think, one of the questions we have is, whoever is in running the city, or frankly sitting in Lansing, has a direct interest in continuing to execute whatever plan is confirmed by Judge Rhodes. And right now you have political alignment between Lansing and Detroit.
Yeah.
But are you going to have political, if you have a Governor Mark Schauer in January, February, then what happens? And I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that the court order, they're going to be expected to execute whatever that plan is, regardless of who's in charge. So I think there are going to be safeguards. You're going to have a financial advisory board that is going to have sway over the city for, what is it, Rick, about 13 years, I think it is.
They can. The idea is that if the board is relevant if the city isn't doing the things that it's supposed
right.
to do, but the hope is that it'll just fade into the background.
We're talking to Detroit News columnist Daniel Howes. He joins us most Thursdays. Also with us, Rick Pluta, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, talking about the relationship now between Lansing, between Governor Snyder, between Detroit, the bankruptcy court. And we brought up election 2014, which is happening not inside of a vacuum with what's going on right now. And Daniel, you brought up Snyder's leadership and what's going on. Now, Detroit has become an issue for Snyder, but maybe not as much as we all sort of thought when he first appointed Kevin Orr, or even when the bankruptcy file began. How surprised are you, Rick, by the fact that Detroit isn't making as many headlines in the gubernatorial race as maybe we thought it would?
Well, I guess I'm not terribly surprised, but that's also very good news for Rick Snyder because, you know, the headlines would typically be about things that are going wrong. And as a matter of fact, you know, the good news that we opened this segment with is also political good news for the governor because it shows that it's working. Everything is locking into place the way that people were hoping that it would. And a dearth of headlines, especially grim ones, is just plain good news for the governor.
Daniel, you brought up Snyder's Democratic challenger, Mark Schauer. What is the sense? I mean, you talk to these folks daily, sometimes more than just once or twice a day. What is their sense about if a Schauer administration took over? What would happen right now?
Oh, Lord knows. I think you can pretty much categorically state that certainly the Southeast Michigan business community, and I would say generally across the board at the Business Leaders for Michigan type of level, there's almost probably unanimous support for Rick Snyder's reelection. And to Rick's point, I mean, the headlines on the bankruptcy are very positive. The thing that I find very perplexing is how close this race appears to be based on the polling that's being done, because I think in general a lot of the things tend to be positive. I would also add that it doesn't appear to me that the governor's running a very effective campaign. And, you know, some of his ads have kind of dropped with a thud, and I don't think that's serving him very well. But in general, I think a lot of people would look at a Schauer governor as kind of a Granholm 3.0.
And again, we're talking here about the business leaders and folks. There's there's a different scenario among those, you know, Detroiters,
right,
which is a mostly Democratic city. Rick, your thoughts?
I don't think if there were a Schauer administration that you would see a dramatic change in direction. That Dan is absolutely right about, you know, what the business leaders are thinking and wanting. But one, a lot of this is just plain locked into place, that, you know, it's the policy and it's going to be the policy going forward. Secondly, you know, at this juncture, at this moment in time, it seems to be working. And if it's working, it would be kind of crazy to change it. I would like to, you know, toss in one thing about, you know, the long-term prospects, because, you know, we're talking a lot about the unity that we're seeing, how things seem to be working, the good news, and, you know, everyone kind of linking arms and singing kumbaya.
Yeah.
One thing we do know is that will not last, that running a large city is a big, complicated, messy, loud business. And if democracy is going to be restored, that part of it is going to be restored at some juncture too, and that's, you know, the part that's going to have to be managed over the long term.
But I think you just used a very important word, managed.
Mm.
And I think
yes.
If you go back and you look at the last several mayors of the city of Detroit, and the last however many iterations of council, there was an absolute appalling dearth of management. And I think when the big stories are written and books are written about this bankruptcy, it is fundamentally going to be a failure of management. And it's one of the reasons that they got to where they got. And one of the reasons I think you're also seeing a lot of movement is you're getting more professional management. And I think in Mike Duggan, you have a very different kind of cat than you've had in the past in terms of someone that has management chops and has done it both in the public and private sectors. And that, I think, I'm not saying you're wrong, but I think it is that's a different kind of element that we have to throw into this. I mean, take, for example, his relationship with city council. He has made it his mission to manage the relationship with council. And you look at the council president, Brenda Jones, who looks like a totally different person than she did in previous councils. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has to do with, A, the situation that Rick rightly points out, but also Mike Duggan has made it his goal to manage that relationship and have a productive, not an adversarial relationship with her. He has promoted her in a sense. He has promoted her to business groups. I've heard stories where he has said to them, you need to have her on a panel at Mackinac. You need, and he is pushing her. He is saying, we need to put her front and center. Now, in the past, I can remember being up at Mackinac and having Mayor Dave Bing tell me, in words I can't say on the radio, what he thought.
Oh, come on.
What he thought of city council.
Just pick one.
And I can remember sitting in his office after the first time I heard this, and I finally looked down and I said, why do you do this? Why do you run these people down? If you run them down to me, they know how you feel, because it's public. And you would never see a Mike Duggan or hear him do that, because he knows those relationships are too important.
Well, in the last minute or so that we have, a quick lightning round, I want from both of you, what are you going to be watching for, let's say, in the next couple weeks, maybe even to a month, in terms of this relationship between Lansing and Detroit? Rick, I'll start with you.
I think what Kevin Orr puts in place in his final days as Detroit's emergency manager to set the city up for what comes next.
Dan?
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. I think that's a real critical thing, but I think that will also be influenced by where we are in the trial and whether we get some more creditors in the tent. And if we do, I think that that certainly redounds to, as Rick's already said, to the governor's benefit and that things are, quote, working. I think that's going to be one of the things to be watching. The other thing that I think is very interesting is to see whether this gubernatorial race particularly breaks one way or another over the next month, and if you can get a sense that there's a momentum in one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes and Rick Pluta, Capital Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network and my co-host of It's Just Politics. Thanks to you both.
Oh, you bet.
Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. Check out stories you might have missed on the website, michiganradio.org. Just click the link that says Stateside. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Michelle Hahn, and Annie Norris. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for listening.